A new generation of struggles in today's America calls for a new generation's solutions. Solutions that reflect millennial impatience with the pace of social change during their lifetime. Patrice Cullors, co-founder of Black Lives Matter, was born long after the civil rights movement and the passage of federal equal rights legislation, and has seen the ways in which Dr. King's dream has fallen short. We spoke about the reasons the country needed Black Lives Matter.
I think for many of us, we were longing for something that spoke to our generation's suffering, our generation's neglect, and the impact that state violence and policing and surveillance and court systems had on our communities and our families. And so Black Lives Matter really comes at a moment where many of us have been calling out our local governments, our national governments. Many of us are highly disappointed in the promise of Obama, the hope of Obama. And Black Lives Matter becomes a clarifying moment. It becomes this sort of searing light, and it doesn't just call Black folks into action, it calls all of us into action.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this moment really called for Black Lives Matter because it had been, multiple decades after the Black Power Movement, multiple decades after the Chicano Power Movement, the American Indian Movement, and for many of us and our generation, especially those of us who were trained as organizers, we were sort of given this movement and gifted this movement to transform it, change it, and evolve it.
The experience of your parents' generation, your grandparents' generation, there perhaps was a moment in the 60s and 70s when your parents' generation had some reason to hope, at least some laws were changed. Was that hope damaged, destroyed? Did it go away?
Well, my parents were born in the 60s, and so didn't really get to experience the sort of height of a civil and human rights movement. Instead, it's the tail end of their youth. My mother had me at a young age. My father had me at a young age. So it's the tail end of their youth where they start to see the ramping up of the war on drugs and the war on gangs. And I think it's our generation that's raised in that ramping up. And that looks like militarized policing. That looks like, living in a time where in 40 years our incarceration goes from 700,000 people to 2.3 million people. And so we are living in a moment of the consequences of a challenge against people fighting for their survival.
Do you think that the Black Power movement of the 60s and 70s was systematically undermined?
Definitely. We know now that it was 100% systematically impacted and demised. I mean, I know so much now about COINTELPRO, about FBI agents coming in and infiltrating the Black Panther Party.
Let's define that, COINTELPRO, for our listeners.
Yeah, well, COINTELPRO was an actual program created and developed by the CIA, in which they brought in infiltrators to disrupt and dismantle powerful groups such as the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
And folks, are still learning about people who they either, were best friends with or married and had children with, who were agents of the state.
Really, really deep cover spying.
Yes.
On America's Black population.
Yes.
Specifically on its activist population.
Yeah, and there's always been a history of undermining Black people who are fighting for their freedom. I mean, I think in our most contemporary sense, we all now know about the Black Identity Extremist report that was that label created by the FBI, calling people who are part of the Black Lives Matter movement Black Identity Extremist, and being able to charge them with things like terrorism. Black Lives Matter was called a terrorist organization. So we're sort of living in this moment, and we've seen it before, And we have much more information about surveillance of black communities than we did during that time. And so I think we're more prepared to deal with it, but it's still deeply challenging to deal with a system that is funneled millions and millions of dollars.
You referred earlier to the disappointment of the Obama years. Was this part of that? Was this happening in the Obama years?
Yes. Trayvon was killed during the Obama years. Mike Brown was killed. Ayanna Stanley Jones was killed. Megan Hockaday was killed. And the list goes on and on. And we think, you know, although I understand the levels of resistance Obama and his administration received, I still believe that he could have pushed further, both domestically and internationally.
He probably got to be president by being somewhat cautious about race.
Of course.
Fair to say?
Yes, and I think every moment in which he dared to be black publicly, he was shamed for it.
He was chastised,
exactly. And so he became more strategic, which meant positioning himself against black activism.
It's not the first time in the history of African Americans that leaders found it necessary to be, as you described it, more strategic, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of compromises to be made, and you know, each generation has been a little bit critical of earlier generations in terms of the compromises they made. Fair to say?
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. And I mean, that's natural evolution. I think for us, when we came on the scene as Black Lives Matter, it was a lot of black women. Most of us are queer, you know, visibly wearing tattoos, or very different generation of a generation that is, you know, that has been bent on kind of gender norms. You know, women wear dresses and
lady-like.
Men wear suits, exactly. And we did not fit that. And so I think there was a lot of backlash about who we were and what we were doing and if we knew what we were doing.
Within the community.
Yeah, within our community and specifically from the old guard. And there's been a lot of headway that's been made. I'm not saying that's everywhere, but in general, there's been a lot of headway that's been made with the old guard and the new guard, and I think that that's important.
What kind of backlash from the old guard? What were some of the things that you would hear?
Oh, we didn't know what we were doing. We had no direction. We were going to not last long. A lot of undermining that was definitely undertones of misogyny and sexism. And it seemed like, for some of them, not everyone, a deep desire to shoo us away.
You know, you mentioned misogyny and sexism, and even back in the civil rights era was, you know, even those on the left didn't really think about it at the time, but it was a very sort of male-dominated movement. The girls went and got coffee.
Totally.
Right? And it's a reminder that we don't move, in terms of social progress, we don't move on every front an equal direction at the same time.
That's exactly right. I think in this moment, though, we've seen leaps and bounds when it comes to challenging gender-based violence. And whether that was from Black Lives Matter, three black women, you know, all of us, you know, call ourselves feminists. And really, you know, reminding people that black women have always been at the helm of social movements and that we're not going anywhere. I think without Black Lives Matter, there wouldn't be a Women's March, there wouldn't be a Me Too movement, there wouldn't be a March for Our Lives. Really, laid the foundation for how we fight.
And you're linking yourselves to a tradition in Black America, aren't you?
We definitely are. We're part of a long legacy of black people who have fought for our freedom from the very moment that we were brought here from the shore on the shores of this country. And I think it's, you know, for many of us, it's an honor to be a part of this movement and to see ourselves as a part of a legacy.
I think there's a strength that comes from being rooted in history.
I absolutely agree. I part of, you know, growing up in America, the unfortunate part is how much America has divorced itself from its history, and that's on purpose. And I think our work is to remind people, not just inside the states, but around the world, that America's past is bloody and it's brutal. And there's always been people at the margins fighting for their freedom.
Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors was in Hawaii last week to share her newly released book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we take a closer look at how we're managing our coastal resources and planning for rising seas. But first, your quiz.
In just a few minutes, we'll be getting an update on beach erosion across Hawaii. And in today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a famous local beach that has experienced some of the worst erosion in the state. You may not realize it when you look at Waimea Bay, but that world-renowned beach used to be a lot bigger. Waimea is notable for the large volume of sand present on the undersea floor. And all that sand began accumulating in the 1890s when a flood washed several tons of silt down from the valley above. That silt provided a firm foundation on which sand began to accumulate. And after 60 years, a significant amount of sand had accumulated, and that did not go unnoticed. In the 1950s, when sand was needed for the construction of Sand Island, Waikiki Beach, and Ala Moana Park, much of it was dredged from Waimea. Anecdotal evidence from the time suggests that sand mining even shaped the bay into the big wave surfing spot it has now become. For today's quiz, we want to know how many feet of beach erosion have occurred at Waimea Bay since 1910. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting The Princess and the Iso Peanut, a Hawaiian pigeon English musical comedy by Lisa Matsumoto and Rosalind Catraccia, opening Thursday. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
King tides grabbed the headlines last year as we watched our shores battered by rising seas and unusually high tides. So what's in store for us this summer? This morning we talked with Dolan Ebersole, a coastal geologist with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College, about managing our coastal resources as we face rising warming waters.
Last summer we saw water levels that were on the order of almost a foot higher than they should have been. And the important message there is that was a glimpse of our future. When we see the elevated water levels, that's what the future might look like in, 20 to 30 years. A foot of water level made a huge difference. Actually, what we learned was it only takes about 6 or 8 inches of increased water to really start to notice a difference on the shorelines throughout the state with increased erosion, coastal inundation of low-lying areas, and things like that. So the first thing to note that's different this year is that we have close to normal water levels, which is good. So we don't see the increased erosion and things like that due to the seasonal anomaly. However, we still are experiencing around the state chronic erosion, which is a longstanding problem. And in some cases, it's a natural phenomena. In other cases, it's a product of human intervention where we've interfered with sediment flow, seawalls, and things like that that in some cases can have a damaging effect in the shoreline. The good news is we have a very good understanding of what these processes look like, and we're able to quantify what the rates of erosion are around the state. And this is done primarily through a research effort at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. And what we're able to do is map historical shoreline positions using aerial photography, historical aerial photography, and that gives us a snapshot of where the shoreline was. And we can go through time and progressively map the sequence of the shoreline position. And in the end, we come up with an erosion rate, an annual erosion rate. And that type of data is extremely helpful for people like myself that are responsible to help manage the shoreline and coastlines. And in the case of Kauai and Maui, they're actually using this data, the historical shoreline change data, for their coastal construction setbacks. So how close you can build to the shoreline is actually a function of your erosion rate. So it's a formula that's used. In Oahu and Hawaii Island, it is just a preset distance. On Oahu, it's 40 feet from the shoreline. But it's encouraging to see the use of this type of data in what we call a variable coastal setback, so that the faster your shoreline is eroding, the further back you have to set your new development. Now, the important thing here is, of course, those type of laws and policies only apply to new development, not existing development. So many of the older structures, we look at a place like Waikiki, where there's lots of high-density urban development right on to the shoreline, those were built prior to these laws being established.
Right, but there is focus on how do we deal with this, with the rising waters and protecting the infrastructure and the buildings that are there.
That's right. I'm very encouraged to see what's been happening statewide through legislation and through policies at the county level. In the last 5 years, there's been a huge transition into awareness of climate change. The science has really been helpful in making these legislative decisions to enact new laws. Whereas maybe prior to 5 years ago, there was still a lot of discussion about, well, climate change science is uncertain. We're not really sure if we want to, take proactive measures just yet. Let's see what the science tells us. Whereas now, I think the science is overwhelming and the political environment has changed to where it's a sense of now we need to do something. And the science is telling us that things are changing and they're changing quickly. And the predictions in the future, when we look at things like sea level rise, are telling us that this problem will continue to accelerate and the rate of change is increasing with time. Therefore, we need to take more proactive measures. And a couple of things that have happened just in the last couple of years that are very encouraging is the state of Hawaii has adopted legislation that requires the state develop a climate change adaptation plan. The first component of this plan, I should back up and say we'll be one of about a dozen states in the nation that are actively working on a climate adaptation plan. So we're not alone. But we're kind of at the forefront of developing climate adaptation plans nationwide. So that's a very encouraging thing. And the first component of this climate adaptation plan is to, in fact, do a sea level rise risk and vulnerability assessment statewide. That portion of the climate adaptation plan is complete, and anybody interested in this issue can simply Google Hawaii Sea Level Rise Viewer, or you can go to the Hawaii Climate Change Portal, and you can access the full report. What most people would probably be most interested in is the viewer, which is a Google Maps interface viewer that shows you what different incremental changes in sea level rise will look like statewide. You can zoom into communities and turn on and off various layers. Now, the important thing about this viewer is it looks at sea level rise, it looks at sea level plus erosion, and sea level plus seasonal high surf. So it's not just a static, what we call a bathtub model, which doesn't account for erosion or waves. In this model, it actually is more of a dynamic model that accounts for these various processes combined with sea level. So it is a future look at what sea level rise could look like statewide. And it's a very important piece of information for decision makers and planners to use on deciding where future development may or may not occur. And if we are serious about adaptation to sea level rise, what kind of measures should we be taking to adapt to things like sea level rise that might be on the order of about 3 feet, at least 3 feet by the end of this century. So that's some of the things that are coming out of this legislation are enactment of sea level rise planning benchmarks. Right now, there isn't an adopted standard for what do we plan for and by when, but that is forthcoming, and there's active discussions going on right now through new climate change commissions that have just recently been set up, and they have written up draft language for consideration by both the city and the state, the city and county of Honolulu and the state of Hawaii, to consider enacting requirements that we plan for certain levels of sea level rise in the future.
So if you own property or live along the coast, that report that you mentioned would be important to look at. But there's also a lot of focus on our economic engine, which is in Waikiki, and you're involved in a project there. What can you share at this point about the snapshot in Waikiki?
Yeah, Waikiki is a really important component of our economy, our culture, our recreation. Waikiki offers so much to both residents and the visitors. I think most people will agree that the beaches in Waikiki are an essential component to the economy, and therefore Waikiki distinguishes itself as a little different than many of the other coastal environments around the state. And I'd like to point that out because, one, it's important to recognize that Waikiki is completely man-made. There really isn't a natural segment of shoreline left in Waikiki. We've either altered it with structures or filled it with sand pretty much continuously between Diamond Head and Pearl Harbor. So it's an urban environment, and I would classify Waikiki as an urban beach. So if we accept that it is a little different, it's an urban environment that's heavily altered already, and in some places entirely engineered, then maybe taking more natural approaches like what we refer to as managed retreat, where we slowly step back away from the coast, is perhaps a good long-term option for a place like Waikiki, but really isn't going to benefit us immediately because they're very difficult to achieve, these retreat strategies. So instead, we're focusing, at least for in the short term, on engineering solutions and alternatives to help stabilize Waikiki Beach. If the goal is to maintain a sandy beach in Waikiki, then the focus should be to take a critical look at the structures and features in Waikiki that serve to define Waikiki as we know it, and try to attempt to do an assessment of the stability of these structures. I can share one example is the Royal Hawaiian Groin, which directly fronts the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. It serves as a really critical terminal groin, which is, you could think of it like a dam. And this vertical concrete wall literally holds together Waikiki Beach as we know it. Unfortunately, that structure is about 90 years old, and it's starting to show signs of its age. It's bowing and cracking, and the engineers are telling us they're afraid that it could fail at any point. There's not much holding it together. So there's an effort to replace this structure with a new feature that would function in a very similar way, but be composed potentially of a different type of material, rocks, stacked rocks, rather than a vertical concrete wall.
And that Royal Hawaiian Groin Project is about a year and a half to 2 years out. But Dylan Ebersole is encouraged that for the first time, Hawaii is incorporating sea level rise into its engineering design. Ebersole has been tapped to act as the manager for the Waikiki Beach Erosion Project. For more information and links about this issue, visit our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii is a perfect place to watch evolution in action. Aloha, this is Dr. Malia Rivera. I'm a scientist and educator and excited to be sharing with Ira Flatto ways we're trying to weave Hawaii place-based learning into STEM curriculums. We'll also talk about one of our island's quirky species radiations. Join us to learn more about it.
First Take with Science Friday at Hawaii Theater Center, July 6th. Tickets at hprtickets.org. Sponsored in part by Prince Waikiki and the Westin Hapuna Beach Resort.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. As we get closer to Election Day, there's lots of attention on debates and forums in the community, and Nathan Eagle joins us on the line. Morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
You've been focusing on the race for governor, and I understand there were two forums yesterday, or two debates.
There was one in the morning hosted by some of the tourism groups, and then one in the evening hosted by Hawaii News Now.
So what was your sense? Any clear winners in the forums that you saw?
You know, not really. I mean, there was a lot of the familiar campaign themes that they were hitting hard with Governor Ige talking about how he's doing the right things for the right reasons. And Hanabusa, of course, saying she has this proven record of leadership. But there weren't really a whole lot of specifics. And they kind of went back and forth on different points.
Now, I've been traveling, and I was really kind of amazed to see how a lot of the ads, the election ads, were just really pretty kind of dirty, you know, in Chicago and New York. And obviously our elections here, our campaign ads are pretty tame in comparison. But, you know, obviously this race is an important one. And we did see one of the three candidates' main contenders drop out in the primary here. Senator Clayton Hee stepped away. You know, what's your take on how the candidates did yesterday in the forum, you know, given that they've got some undecided voters to kind of sway to their camp?
You know, the contrast was really clear, not so much between the candidates for governor, you know, David Ige, of course, and Colleen Hanabusa, but between the races, because it was a long night of debates. We saw the lieutenant governor's race, then we saw the first congressional district race candidates. There's five and six candidates apiece in those. And then we saw last the main show, the governor's debate. Ige and Hanabusa stayed, you know, respectful. They disagreed, but they stayed very respectful. I'd say the same thing for the LG's race. Got a little bit more heated during the congressional district race. So I'm not sure if we're going to see more of that in the race for governor as we enter this home stretch or not, but it's something we'll be watching for.
Now, I imagine there are going to be a few more forums before the August election. You think they're just going to get maybe a little bit more feisty?
I think it's entirely possible. I mean, it's really crunch time. You know, we've got, August 11th is the primary. I think ballots go out a couple weeks before that. So we are really, really in crunch time now, and I think the gloves may come off.
What was your assessment of the forum that you watched last night? Where were the points made on either side?
You know, they each took swipes at each other over some familiar things we've heard. For Hanabusa, it was the false missile alert that Ige fumbled back in January. On the other side, he's coming back at her with the Ko'olina sweetheart tax deal that she was involved with when she was in the state Senate. So we built on those a little bit, added a few more layers with some of the other topics. The lieutenant governor and his relationship with Shan Tsutsui came up, affordable housing, of course, homelessness, and a bunch of others.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see if the gloves, in fact, do get off and if we see more jabs taken in the ads in the weeks to come. Thanks a lot, Nathan.
I'll be watching. Thank you.
All right. That was reporter Nathan Eagle talking about today's reality check. To read the stories about the candidates vying for your vote, visit civilbeat.org.
Most of us have a passive approach to chronic pain management, and that's where we get in trouble. Pain medication is an essential short-term solution, but long-term use, carrying with it the threat of addiction, is problematical. Daniel Lev is a clinical psychologist who says pain management is a skill that each of us has the power to develop. His book is called You Are Bigger Than the Pain, and we spoke yesterday.
The way I look at it is popping the pill is just one skill, one thing you can do to increase the comfort in your body. The problem is, you know, it's very limited. It can be dangerous if you use too much. And everyone who uses pain pills know that it's very limited in its effectiveness because no matter how much you take, it will always go back down after a few weeks to a certain level of comfort. And there's only really two doses of the pills that will get rid of all the pain. One's the lethal dose, so you're dead, and the other's the zombie dose, so you can't have much of a life there. You're just laying around. So
that happens to a lot of people,
it
right?
It does. It does. And so doing something quite different, like, well, I like to say, you know, you see the doctor says, I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. You just have to live with it. And they're somewhat incorrect. There's actually one other source of help, and that's you. You have you and things you can do. And that's, again, a lot what the book's about is skills. Things you can do actually change the pain process.
In Western culture, we're not much into harnessing the power of the mind, at least not as much as in Eastern cultures, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
Fair to say?
That's changing. There's a lot of research. I got my doctorate in clinical psychology, and my dissertation was on meditation. And looking at the research back then, about 25 years ago, now there's 25 years more research showing that it is a health practice as one skill. And so some of those things from the East have been essentially put together in a way that can help people from the West.
It's still 25 years as opposed to 5,000.
This is true. This is very true. It's not in our culture, although it slowly is being used.
Is it effective?
Quite effective. I mean, one of the first people, John Kabat-Zinn, back in Massachusetts in the late 70s, started applying a little bit of yoga, mindfulness meditation, and some body relaxation. And he found it made significant changes in the amount of meds people use, how active they were, and how happy they were after 8 weeks.
Do you find that people in chronic pain are some stubborn customers as far as selling them on the idea of pain management without medication?
And this is a fabulous thing you bring up because it is a wonderful stereotype, okay? Oh, those pain patients, they're so hard to deal with. Well, they're dealing with some hard stuff, yeah. So you'd be cranky too.
Well, I'm not condemning it.
I'm not,
you know,
you're saying it. You're saying that, but they do get that a lot, and other people in my profession feel that way. Oh, God, not another pain patient. And really, I love working with people who are dealing with the hardest things in life. Okay, I learn a lot from them. In fact, I don't even call them pain patients. I call them people in pain because that's what they're dealing with.
The first time one of these people in pain walks in, what kind of things do you tell them?
It just depends on the person. But in general, my basic orientation is after getting to know them a little bit and what some of their goals are, what they want to accomplish, I'll share with them how pain works, okay? And the skinny of it is essentially when it comes to chronic pain, it starts to function beyond the damage that started the pain. So even if you have a bad back, a lot of the pain process is due to the brain and nervous system, which in a way has been trained by the pain condition to be hypersensitive to pain. And once they understand that a lot of it has to do with their brain being hypersensitive, then you can learn some ways to desensitize that nervous system, to calm it. And as you do that, you start feeling more comfortable.
You just reminded me of something. If you have a cut on your hand and you haven't noticed it, mm-hmm. and then you see it, now it hurts.
Sometimes that's true, too. It's the meaning we attribute to the pain. So Dr. Beecher, a very famous physician in World War II, was a surgeon. He helped soldiers coming out of the Japanese, one of the battles there, and he was noticing that a lot of the soldiers were not in a lot of pain. They weren't asking for pain meds. And he found out essentially the reason why is, what does the wound mean? What does the pain mean? It means I'm going home. It means I'm going to live. So for them, their wounds were positive, okay, versus patients he found in hospitals back in the States. It was the exact opposite.
Because with the same wound.
With the same kind of wound. Oh, my God, am I going to get back to work? You know. So it matters on how we see the meaning as well as how things that we can do that can help our bodies feel better and do more.
Have there been clinical studies where it's demonstrated, let's say, that a person under hypnosis can endure extreme pain that you can...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, some people are more hypnotizable than others, but it is a skill, and you can learn to do that. Every person I see at the end of, I do an evaluation, at the end of the evaluation, I teach them a very simple little meditation technique, 5 minutes, and ask them beforehand, 10 is, I feel great, 0 is, I feel terrible. That's physically, emotionally, and I'd say 9 times out of 10, people feel better after 5 minutes of meditation, which is, you could say, 2/3 of hypnosis. You're focusing and you're relaxing. Hypnosis adds the idea of taking in ideas and a very potent way to help people. And that's one of the skills in the book.
Most first-time meditators, the first few minutes of trying to, have a pretty terrible time, right?
Yeah.
Snakes in the attic and all kinds of noises being made up
there.
Oh,
yeah. And it's quite incredibly normal. In fact, meditation really, at least the formal, a way to look at a formal aspect of meditation is you're sitting down and you're trying to focus your attention, okay? And you're going to get distracted. It's very normal. So if I'm following my breathing and then I start thinking about the laundry and all kinds of things in that movie last night, and people, they come and say, I can't do it. I said, why not? Well, I keep getting distracted. I said, that's part of it. In fact, one of the categories of the skills I have, I call refocusing skills, because it's not about staying focused. It's about remembering, oh, I'm going to focus back now. You get distracted, you just bring your mind back. The longer you do that, the easier it is to bring your mind back and focus.
It's like flexing a muscle.
It's like driving a car. You know, it's a skill. The more you practice it, the better you get, and then it has amazing positive effects on the body. And that's just one skill, meditation.
You know, they, at first blush, one might look at the title of your book and think you're talking about an entire alternative to pain medication, but you seem quite comfortable with integrating your methods with application of pain medication. Is that right?
Absolutely. I used to work in the Kaiser system and in an interdisciplinary pain program with a physician, psychologist, physical therapist, acupuncturist, the whole schmear, which is what we're starting hopefully soon in Kaneohe. In that, essentially, I take a pills and skills approach, and you find the right balance. And often people are focused on pills because that's the only thing they've been told. You know, it's like you go to a doctor, the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. All right? So it makes sense because it's really useful. Medicine's useful for acute pain, for pain that's going to heal, but for chronic pain, not so much. And so, absolutely, getting this kind of training can help.
Daniel Lev is the author of You Are Bigger Than the Pain, 6 Comfort Strategies for People in Chronic Pain, published by Comfort Skills Press.
Hi, I'm Erin Lau from the Ohina Film Showcase. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about erosion at one of Hawaii's most famous beaches. Waimea Bay is known for big wave surfing in the winter and an expansive, tranquil beach in the summer. The bay's famous Jump Rock is a popular summertime attraction, and that rock now stands roughly 15 feet above the surface of the ocean. But once upon a time, it was almost completely buried in sand. That was back in the early 1900s, before erosion and sand mining had reduced sand levels and moved the shoreline. Sand mining at Waimea began in the 1950s in order to provide sand for the construction of Ala Moana Beach Park, Sand Island, and Waikiki Beach. Several years later, early surfers began paddling out at Waimea, Big wave pioneer Fred Van Dyke even went so far as to suggest a connection between the reduced sand level and the bay's suitability for huge surf. We'll likely never know for sure, but we do know that since 1910, there have been over 200 feet of beach erosion at Waimea Bay, which was today's answer. Now, we managed to stump our listeners. No winners today, but we have a photo of Waimea showing the 1910 sand level posted on our website. And if you have an idea for us for the quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Each year's UH Kids First Film Festival reminds us of a whole world of movies we wouldn't be likely to see any other way. It's a curated selection of movies from around the world that speak the language of kids in ways that mainstream cinema rarely does. The Summer Festival has been running since 2007. Anne Brandman is its director, and she joins us in our studio. Hi, Anne. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me here again.
You know, I wonder why these movies aren't more widely available. Whenever I see the selection that you bring in, they just look great for kids. But I guess because they're short, they don't make it to the multiplex. Is that part of it?
That's true. Some of them are short. Some of them that we show are also features. Some go directly to DVD. Mm-hmm. Some the kids know about. Some are on Netflix. So there's a broader array of platforms that these films can show on. But some of these short independents, they don't get shown as often as they should. There's a film festival circuit, and that's where they travel.
Yeah.
And then the filmmakers can get exposure and perhaps get a little funding and make something that more people can see. But
well, it seems like a shame because the children's movie is an art in itself, isn't it?
It's true. It's like short stories for kids, literature. Another form of communication for kids.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about children's literature, movies, anything like that, is the artist's task of getting inside the mind of a child. It might seem easy, but I'm not sure it is.
I think a lot of us bury that child.
Yeah.
Maybe an artist, though, can tap into that, and maybe that's a relief for that artist, and somehow you can find that child within, hopefully.
It was a very enjoyable world to be in.
Well, I think I had some mixed feelings about that world.
But
my own internal world was very enjoyable.
Well,
And that's what a lot of these films, I find, are about. They're about the power of creative imagination. And in children's films, I think, without going into a lot of special effects, the mind or the internal life of the child can be revealed. And it doesn't take a lot.
There's a lot of the messages seem to revolve around a kind of, you can do it, don't be discouraged. Do you see that?
Very much so. It's about resiliency, about connection, about reconciliation with family, with nature, and so forth. These films, like independent films for adults, they are not formulaic in the same way that some of the blockbusters are.
Yeah.
You don't come to expect certain things. Girls don't necessarily look like princesses, but they are heroes in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
People look the way our community looks.
The way people look.
That's right. That's right. Multicultural, intergenerational. So that's the same with a lot of these children's films. And it's taken me 12 years to realize how much I'm in love with them.
Here's an excerpt from one of them, which is a movie called The Boxcar Children, Surprise Island.
I used to like exploring the island. And you can go swimming and fishing whenever you feel like
it. Oh, I love fishing. Can Watch go too?
Certainly. He would be lonesome without you.
Yay!
Come on, let's get packing.
We need dishes. Spoons, cups, bowls. We better make a list.
Worms, Jesse. Don't forget worms.
Don't worry, we'll get plenty of worms.
Well, aside from, you know, bring along plenty of worms, what kind of message does this one pass along?
First of all, I was wondering if you recognized the voice of the grandfather.
Martin Sheen.
Right, exactly.
I had to cheat.
Oh, okay.
But I did recognize
him. Yeah, he's a strong presence in these films. The message for the Boxcar Children, I think, is exactly that. They're orphans who come to find their grandfather eventually, but these kids are self-sufficient and self-reliant and very creative with their environment. In fact, the author of the book, which is, I guess, the NEA considers it like one of the top 100 children's books by teachers, I lost my train of thought. I was talking
so
about
did I.
It. the author, Gertrude Chandler Warner, said that when she first wrote The Boxcar Children, librarians were protesting because the kids were on their own. And she said that's exactly why the children loved the book.
Yeah. Well, it takes a certain amount of daring to, get at the fundamental fear of children, separation anxiety, by having kids be orphans.
That's true.
You would think it would be taboo to even mention that, something that scary.
That's true. But these kids have such a deep connection with each other as a unit, as a family unit, that they are able to sustain themselves. But a lot of the Boxcar Children films and books are about the adventures that they go on and their ability to overcome any adversity. So,
is this genre of films getting more daring in terms of the themes it allows itself to present?
I find that in terms of the children's films that I've been viewing, they do look to issues of our day. Some of the films deal with grieving or a loss of a parent. Certainly, there are a lot of films now that deal with bullying. Mm-hmm. And we've got a beautiful film from the United Kingdom that deals with a girl who's a little bit different than other kids and is dealing with bullying. So, yeah, I think that's the thing about independent films, is that they can tackle what is important to kids and what is universally important, but also what is currently important.
Let's hear another excerpt. This is from a movie called The Bake Shop Ghost.
We remember our sister, Cora Lee, who lived among us for these past 72 years and made our lives richer by her talent. Some said her sponge cake was so light it could float right up to the angels in heaven. And I personally enjoyed her tiramisu, so smooth and creamy, a light dusting of cocoa, and a dollop of whipped cream. Oh, my.
This is a eulogy for
exactly.
A deceased baker.
Exactly, who was very well known in the community, but had a sort of all of her sweetness went into her cake. So
she
had a little bit of a sour disposition nonetheless. She is well remembered by the town.
Well, I love that this is the minister giving the eulogy
yes.
And the sensuality in his voice when he talks about the light dusting.
And you better believe that everybody in the church is also practically drooling with delight.
It's really refreshing for kids to be taken away from formulas, because it's kind of the time of life when, you know, you want to know what your options are, right?
That's very true. And it's the time for great development. And we know that kids are in front of screens a good portion of their time.
Yeah.
So you want them to be able to be exposed to some of these, the images and the ideas that help with their development.
In their being in front of screens as much as they are they more aware of the language of cinema, you know, in terms of what it edits and you know, how cinema conveys certain things through its rhythms? Do you think they're getting more sophisticated?
Oh, I think so. I think also the ability to actually make movies on your own telephone or your computer or whatever, I think they have become more aware of the vocabulary of film, but that's one of the reasons why Kids First exist. It's to help support media literacy so kids can critique the language of films and understand what they're watching and be able to analyze it.
And maybe even think of it as something they themselves could do. Yeah,
absolutely. That's the next step.
Thanks, Anne. Anne Bramman is the director of the UH Kids First Film Festival, which runs July 8th and 15th in the UH Manoa Art Auditorium. Shows start at 3 p.m. and screenings and parking are free.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
If there's such a thing as Polynesian fusion rock, Tawana is its biggest star, wrote the Honolulu Weekly. HPR invites this original talent to the Atherton Studio on Saturday, July 14th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for Tawana in the Atherton on the 14th. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. We're off tomorrow to celebrate the nation's birthday. We'll be back on Thursday with Science Friday host Ira Flatow, and we'll be taking your calls.
And I like Science Fridays. We hope you'll join us. Tell us what's on your mind, call our talkback line, and leave us a message. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We hope you'll join us on Thursday for more of The Conversation. Mm-hmm.